Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justyna and Paul.
Hello, Justyna.
Hi, Paul. Nice to see you again. It's crazy that in this quarantine, we actually see each other every few hours.
Yes, we've had three meetings today, different Zoom meetings. But yeah, we don't spend as much time together when we're not quarantined as we do these days. So how are you holding up?
Actually, I'm doing pretty good. I don't know why so many people are complaining that they are bored at home. I think that there's always so many things that you can learn and do that there's not enough time, even not enough time. So I'm doing pretty good. But my friend, she told me, okay, wait when it will be like 3 weeks, like I'm right now, when you want to just bite the walls and get out of the building. So I guess like maybe 12 days as far as I am so far, it's still okay, but who knows what will happen next weeks. And you, Paul?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm just, I think it's important to remember when we're talking about how comfortable it is to work from home, how many people can't work from home. The vast majority of people don't have jobs now. The vast majority of people are not getting paid right now. And most of the people who are getting paid to risk their lives. So we are in an insanely privileged position to be able to earn a salary sitting at home.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm not going to complain.
Yeah. Also, I'm very excited about all the innovations that are coming to the market very soon because, you know, people under pressure and crisis mood, they are really struggling to come up with like the best possible ideas. Yes. So I expect a huge boom of startups that will disrupt our lives.
And clever ideas for helping to address some of the problems created by the pandemic, as well as I'm also watching distance education. I used to be involved in distance education. That was my first job after getting my MBA, was designing distance education programs for the Big Ten universities. But that was over 20 years ago, and there's so many tools and techniques out there now. And suddenly all of the trainers, like ourselves, are trying to find ways to deliver content online. And obviously they're going to struggle a lot, but that also means that there's a lot of people who are not coming from the established approaches to distance education who are going to be having fresh and innovative ideas. So that's going to be fun too. Oh, and maybe this pandemic will spawn a whole bunch of new podcasters as well, because that's one thing you can definitely do at home when you've got nothing but you and a quiet room and your phone or your laptop.
Join us
in the podcast world. It's fun.
But also I have a huge hope to the whole society that after this pandemic period of time, everyone will really appreciate the possibility of actually going out, going for a dinner, taking a longer walk than 1 kilometer from your household. You know, so many little things that I think we forgot to appreciate on a daily basis.
A kilometer? We have a trash chute in our building for trash, but in order to dump recycling, you've got to take it around outside to the back of the building. And so I am just eagerly spending the days watching my recycling fill up, and I can't wait till it gets full so I can walk 50 meters outside. And I made a terrible mistake. The last time I did it, the recycling was full and I had to take it out, but I did it in the afternoon when the sun is on the other side of the building. So I walked around the building and I dumped the recycling, walked back in and never felt the sun. So now I know the trick is when the recycling is full, I have to take it out in the morning so I can feel the sun on my face for 30 seconds.
Exactly. And also I never thought that I would be so excited about the food delivery, like, you know, checking what time will they arrive, if they already packed everything. Like I never expected that getting food delivered to your house would be so exciting, like the highlight of a day, really.
Well, especially when you're a vegetarian and you've got, we've got like weekly food deliveries. And so we've got fresh vegetables at the beginning of the week, but then we're pretty much scraping the cupboards by the end of the week, having a lot of things like bulgur wheat and kasha and homemade pasta. And I'm really enjoying cooking, but the vegetables aren't lasting. And so every single time we get a new delivery, that means we can start making curries and salads again for a while.
Yeah. Challenging.
It is challenging, but, you know, challenges create challenges what is it? Creativity thrives on constraints. And so I've done things in the kitchen that I would never have thought possible before. There's no yeast in the store. You can't get yeast to save your life in this place. In America, they run out of toilet paper first. In Poland, it seems to be yeast. And I think it's because Easter's coming up and traditional Polish Easter cakes are yeast-based, and nobody wants to miss out on their traditional Easter cakes. But all the yeast is gone. And so it's taken me a week and a half to raise the starter and form the dough and such. It actually takes 3 days once you've got good sourdough starter to make a loaf of sourdough bread. So it's taken me almost 2 weeks to make one loaf of sourdough bread, but it was so good. Oh my, it was good.
Which reminds me, my sister, she was ordering shopping and I told her, can you please get me peanut butter? And they're like, yes, 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 no problem. And then I met with her and I'm asked, where is my peanut butter? Oh, I got you peanuts and butter. And I was like, no, I wanted peanut butter. Yeah.
Not the same.
But I made homemade peanut butter with banana. And ooh, that nice. Was awesome for the oatmeal. Delicious. For this oatmeal that you put in the jar for night, as Edita was describing, I made this one with a homemade peanut butter with banana. Amazing.
Very nice. Yeah. I haven't made homemade peanut butter in a long time. I should try that. Because we do have time. Lots of time to cook. Today we're going to be talking to George Dinwiddie, the author of Software Estimation Without Guessing, Effective Planning in an Imperfect World. A long title for a short book full of fabulous nuggets of wisdom. And I hope you're looking forward to meeting him as much as I am.
I do. Hello.
Hello, George.
Hi, George.
Hello.
Very nice to meet you.
Yes.
Very nice to meet you also.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us. We read your book and we enjoyed it very much. The review is going to be out on the 1st. I'm still working on editing it. But we have some questions, and I'm sure our audience is going to have some questions as well. Justina, you want to start?
Yes, definitely. So basically, I even said that in the book review that one of the reasons why I wanted to read the book was actually Liz's recommendation, because I kind of trust her judgment. And I was very happy with your book, especially that in the past years, I was a little bit annoyed with this no estimate movement. Like, okay, I understand the point of view, but your book, it brought me, you know, the perspective on how estimates might be useful, that there is completely different point of view on that. But I was actually curious, what was the book reception that you got? What the audience told you?
Well, it's a little hard to judge. You know, you don't get a lot of feedback from the audience of a book. When I was writing the book, then I realized this was going to upset people on both ends of the spectrum. And I decided that's probably a good thing, because the ends of the spectrum are not really where you want to be. You want to think about what you're trying to accomplish with estimates and accomplish that at the most reasonable cost you can. And when you've got people on one side who are trying to estimate everything in great detail and expecting that to give them both high precision and great accuracy. And then you've got other people that just say, oh, don't do anything. Things will get done when it gets done. There's no point in looking forward at the future. And neither one of those really work in the long run.
There is this problem in our industry that when people hear a number, they put it into a calendar. There's this, that you ask for an estimate. And in fact, so often people are asked for just a general estimate, just a high level estimate, just a rough guess. And then next thing you know, you're held accountable for it. Could you, I'm sure all of our listeners have experienced this. Can you give our listeners some indication of what are the warning signs that the estimate that you're providing is being taken as a commitment, and what might they do about that?
Oh, that's so hard to tell, because it varies so much from place to place what the warning signs are. Because we're in the people issues here. You know, does this person or the person, someone that this person will give the information to, do they typically take things as commitments and then expect them to be exact? And, you know, you probably know the answer to that question in whatever organization you're working. And that's a problem. So rather than try to express it in a number, it may be better to express it as an answer to a question. You know, if it's just a raw number, then people try to interpret that in their own way. It's like having a database where none of the columns are explained. And so the numbers, you know, you try to figure out what this value means. But if you don't know what the value meant going into the database, then when you read it out, you're probably wrong. And so it's the same sort of thing here. You need to interpret an estimate in the same way that it was formulated. And if you don't know how it's going to be used, it's really hard to create an appropriate estimate.
It's not so different than trying to compare coronavirus outbreak numbers from country to country without knowing how much they're testing and how they're measuring the results.
Right.
Yeah. I just learned, for example, in Poland, that a person can be diagnosed with a coronavirus and be put under quarantine, but if they die at home, it's not counted as a coronavirus death.
Oh, that's one way to keep the numbers down. Yeah. The last state in the United States to report a coronavirus infection was West Virginia. And so I was wondering, you know, well, maybe, you know, it being a very mountainous state, maybe people are just naturally separated from each other a lot. And I looked into it, and it turned out they had tested 21 people, and all 21 of those tests had been negative. So they really didn't know what kind of problem they had.
Yeah. Well, I guess the ultimate example, of course, of getting the kind of estimates that you want is North Korea, which has none whatsoever.
But I understand they're running low on ammunition.
But that brings us to another point that you made in the book, which is, I think North Korea is a perfect example. What do you do when what you want is the bad news? When the estimate isn't what you want, how can you still get accurate, honest information in a situation in which people are frightened of providing it?
Well, so, yeah, this goes deeply into the people issues, and which is ultimately the reason I wrote the book, because you see so many people get beating each other up over the topic of estimates. So most of the book is about how to do them, how to get value out of them, so that people don't do that. But the last chapter is really about how to deal with the people issues when it's not going well. And, you know, you have to start trying to understand what the needs are of the other person, and how can you attend to those needs as well as your own and the needs of the circumstances around you. You need to balance these things. And that's not always easy. Sometimes it's beyond your capability. Sometimes you're dealing with someone that you can't figure out how to communicate well with. But there's some suggestions in there, you know, that can help. And, you know, like anything else, it's a lifelong learning process to try to get better at it. But in a specific situation, you know, part of it, sometimes the communication just goes wrong. You know, we jump so quickly to a conclusion about what we think the other person is saying that we often don't really hear what they're saying. So slowing that down and seeing where that can go wrong is a big part of it. And trying to understand, well, if, you know, you can check things out. Do I hear you saying this? Is this what you mean? And clarify your understanding. And another thing is, sometimes it still doesn't make sense to you. And you can think about, well, what else do they believe that would make this statement or, you know, make sense to them, make it seem reasonable? They're probably not dumb, evil people.
Oh, actually, like one of the part of the book that I really, really loved was how to deliver a bad news. Like actually the value of having a bad news, like it's as high as the value of a good news. I really love that part. But if I could come back to the beginning of the book, because it already caught my attention when you mentioned that the book is also dedicated for the upper management. And I was just wondering what the senior manager should learn from your book? Like, if you could think one lesson, the most important for the upper management that they should take out from your book, what that would be?
Well, upper management really sets the tone of an organization. And so first and foremost is they should be looking for help in achieving the goals of the organization. You know, having people work together rather than in conflict with each other. It doesn't do the organization any good, you know, to demand an estimate from someone and then get mad at them when that estimate doesn't tell you what you wanted it to tell. That's not helpful. It's sometimes a natural human reaction, but it's not helpful as a management position. So helping them understand how their requests, they may have a question, they ask middle managers, you know, well, how long is this going to take? Because they've got a question in mind. Well, those middle managers don't know what that question is. So they just go down and their directive is to find out how long it's going to take. And so the questions they ask the people who have some insight into how long it might take may lead to a wrong sort of estimate. It may, you know, it may miscommunicate what the scope of the work is. It may miscommunicate who's going to do it, which can affect the estimate. may miscommunicate the amount of precision that's needed, lots of things. So they get this answer back, and that answer doesn't necessarily fit the question that's in the senior manager's head. And so they don't know that. They apply it, and they make a decision based on this answer, and then people get upset when that turns out not to be helpful. So one of the lessons in that is that rather than just asking for an estimate, rather than just telling people what to do, then they need to include them in you know, what depends on this, and provide information along with the question.
Yeah, I think that one of the first chapters of your book was also dedicated to that. It was very useful. It was also one of the takeaways, yeah.
I have a long memory of my career in IT, and it started with an estimate. I think many people's careers in IT start with an estimate. I was the first project manager in a software company almost 25 years ago and had to estimate a project with a team of engineers for the very first time in my life. And obviously, I do it very differently now with hundreds of projects under my belt. But back then, I really had nothing to go on except just to trust what people told me and plug it into a Gantt chart. You have a lot of advice in your book on how to use your experience in order to identify the appropriate assumptions and to identify the appropriate size chunks of work and in order to compare them. But for an inexperienced project manager, for people who are new to this, what advice would you give them when they're asked for their first estimate?
Well, so estimates are always based on something you don't know versus something you do know or you think you know. And if you don't have corresponding experience yourself, then you need to go out and get other people's experience and compare it to that. Now, granted, that introduces, you know, some more uncertainty into the estimate. So you probably want to check as many people as you can. You may be able to find data on projects that, you know, similar projects that they mention and be able to look up and, oh, how long did this really take? Sometimes sometimes bad news is erased, though, and doesn't become part of the official record. You find that happens a lot, particularly in low trust environments where we have to report good news or else we get in trouble. So you have to be careful. There are, you know, when I was coming up through the ranks, then I learned fairly early on that you estimate how long you think something's going to take, and then you multiply it by 3. And, you know, that takes accounts for the stuff you don't know, for the optimism, things like that. And that seems like a pretty good factor and pretty well used. It doesn't fit everything, but I had a friend who talked about boat projects, and he said, you think, take how long you think it's going to take to do something on the boat. you multiply that by 3, and then you increment the unit of measurement. So something that you think is going to take a day takes 3 weeks.
And George, do you remember your first estimating experience? Do you remember the first time that someone asked you for the magic number?
Oh, not really. Back when I was a hardware engineering technician, then I wasn't typically asked for many estimates, but I did have to draw the Gantt charts and redraw them on paper, desized, that they would then take into the high-level meetings. I did have one of the hardware engineers asked me to wire up a circuit for him one time. He showed me the schematic and asked how long it would take. And I looked at it and I said, oh, I could have that done for you this morning. And he says, I'm not asking you to make a career out of it. He says, I just want the circuit wired up. I said, well, I've got to lay out the circuit board and wire up. He says, no, I just want it wired up. Just solder right to the chip. Yeah. So I didn't understand what question he had. And so I said, oh, I could get it for you in an hour. And I did it in an hour or less and gave it to him. And I saw him, you know, hook it up to a power supply and check it out with an oscilloscope and stuff. And he spent about an hour checking out this circuit, and then he threw it in the trash can. So, you know, I had no idea what he was expecting when I gave him that first estimate. So I was estimating based on past experience, which wasn't applicable.
So how can you communicate an estimate in a way that effectively also communicates your assumptions and uncertainties, especially if you're communicating it to somebody who is several layers above you and you don't get to communicate directly?
Yeah, well, that's tough, because you really need a conversation in order to be able to answer questions, ask questions, verify your understanding of things, writing clearly so that it isn't, you know, misunderstood is very, very hard. And it's, you know, you look at the publishing industry, you know, the writer does the best job they can. Then the editor works with them to improve it and think, you know, tell them, oh, this doesn't come through well. This is confusing. People won't understand that. Let's phrase this differently. Then it goes to a proofreader. You know, there's an army of people and a lot of rewrites before it goes out to people. And then we expect for software developers to be able to write these things clearly and not be misunderstood. And we trust, you know, the reader's opinion of it. And if they read it and get the wrong impression, then we blame the writing.
You know, we interviewed Daniel Vacanti about 4 or 5 months ago. And one of the things he said is that any estimate should also include a range, not a number, but a range, and always a margin of error, always a probability. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've heard that advice a lot, and that's good advice. My problem with that is that that requires more numerical precision than I can generally come up with. You know, how do I tell whether I'm 90% sure of this estimate or 50% sure? You know, maybe I could tell the difference between those, but 60 and 70, that would be tough. You know, I typically have enough uncertainty that I can't measure things to that degree. So I would probably express my uncertainty in different ways. List some of the assumptions I'm making, you know, list some of the caveats. There's a number of ways that the comparison could be different. And there's a section in the book that talks about this. Some of it's out of your hands. You know, if you need clarification on something and you ask for that clarification, how long does it take for you to get an answer back? That's going to, you know, to vary. I worked on a project one time where I was asked for something. This was sort of blue sky. It was a prototype idea to show to the client. And I was asked in very general terms to create something. But then the project manager didn't like what I created, and he starts, you know, no, it needs to do this. Okay. No, it needs to do this. no, that's not good enough. And he couldn't tell me why. And so, you know, that was looking like a perpetual project because I didn't know where the endpoint was. And so if you've got somebody who's going to be real picky with what you return and not be satisfied with it, that can lengthen things greatly. And what influence do you have on that?
Mm-hmm. Indeed, in my last career, I was building web applications, small web applications, and so they were all pretty similar. And we built hundreds of them over a period of over a decade. And so we had a lot of data to go on. But the most important data point that we ever used when doing an estimate was how clearly we felt the customer communicated what they wanted from us.
Right. And that often depends on how well do they understand what they want.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that I was very curious in the recent week, because during reading your book, I was also trying to find different kind of point of view, different point of views on the internet. And one of the blog posts that I came across, it literally said that if you have a project with a fixed date, like, for example, the new GDPR, new privacy policy that comes in the country and that it's obligatory for all of the companies, that there is no point in estimates because you know by when it has to be done. And I was just wondering, what is your point of view on those kind of projects with the fixed date that have to be deployed by a certain time?
Well, I think your estimates change then. So I've been in that situation. I was working with a company and we had to make a change to meet a federal requirement, Securities and Exchange Commission requirement. And if we didn't have it that deployed by April, by January 1st, then there was some large daily fine until we got it out there. So I didn't do a real precise estimate. A lot of estimates come down to one of three values. Either no problem, no way, or it's too close to call. So, in terms of this, then the requirement says one thing, and you have to get at least that done, meet the requirement by that date. Can you do that? In this case, I figured it was pretty much no problem. So my second point was, can I do this without making a mess of the code or increasing the mess that this particular code already had? Can I clean this up? And I thought, well, it's likely that if I clean it up, it will actually go faster because I won't be dealing with as many bugs. But there's more uncertainty there. And so it could be a problem. So I worked on it, watching this, and I knew I could hit the date, but I was watching my progress so that if it started looking like I was jeopardizing getting the minimum requirements out by that date, then I could shift gears and start working differently. But as long as that was looking okay, then I could continue working in a more careful way and improving the software as I went along. Yeah, when you've got a fixed date, you've got to get something out there, but you have to estimate what you can get out there by that date and keep an eye on that.
That was one of the things I really enjoyed. One of the takeaways from your book that I've never come across before is the idea that it can be valuable for a development team to come up with estimates just for their own purposes to test their assumptions that nobody else has to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that doesn't come natural to me. I didn't normally do that. Pool players call that calling your shots. When I played pool in college, I was happy if any ball went into any pocket. I was not good enough to call my shots. But that's how people get better, is by calling the shots. And then when it doesn't work the way they expected, they learn from that. And so they get better at it.
So if you walk to organization where the culture says like no estimates and all of the engineers are pretty against it because they have very bad experience from the past that were only used against them, how do you help them to understand the value of, of estimation? How do you help them to have the conversation that they should have? How do you teach them this culture?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, you know, I think that if that's happening, that's a symptom of deeper problems within the organization. And one of the tools that I use for digging into those problems is the retrospective. So I might have, you know, a retrospective with those developers so, you know, they can share what their views on what happened, what they've seen, because sometimes you find it's a few noisy people who have that opinion and other people are going along with it. And there may be some differences of opinion. Then I think I might also have a separate retrospective, you know, with management. And ultimately, I think you're going to need to have a retrospective with both, you know, with everybody in one room. If you can get them to listen to each other and have dialogue with each other, listen to understand rather than listen to respond. But it's going to take a lot of defusing of the situation before you can get there. You know, it's going to take baby steps. You know, these problems aren't built in a day. They're not going to be solved in a day.
Unfortunately.
You know, it occurs to me that there's no way you could have written Chapter 9 without having a fair number of horror stories in your background. Are there any you can share?
Oh.
Too many?
I don't know that I have any great horror stories. I survived them all. I've been yelled at a number of times. I've gotten laid off a number of times in my career. Sometimes that was for other reasons, though. one time it was, it's kind of funny. I had done a little work on the side for one of the users, internal users, you know, of the prototype system we built, because she needed to be able to see the data in a way that, you know, visualize it in a different way rather than having to look at timestamps in the database. And so I wrote this little visualization tool. And so we were then building the real system. And so she and her coworkers tried to get that added to the requirements. And they said, oh, no, it's too late in the requirements process for that, which I thought was kind of silly. So when we released the first version of that, they said, well, now can we have this visualization? And they said, no, that would be too much work. And she said, well, how much work? So they sent some people off to estimate it, and they came up with something like 6 people for 8 weeks or 8 people for 6 weeks. I forget which. And they came back. And when I'd given her this other visualization tool, I said, whatever you do, don't tell anybody I did this for you. But when they came back with this estimate of, you know, of 48 person weeks, she says, what? George did this in 3 days. And a month later, I got laid off. But, you know, I've had run-ins over estimates, and I've heard of others. And I've also, you know, in the past 20 years, learned a whole lot about the way people interact with each other. You notice that I lean heavily on the work of Virginia Satir in that chapter. And that has given me tools, you know, to deal with the way people work with each other in you know, models to think about, to analyze how things are going. And those tools have been very helpful. Now, I got that introduction to Virginia Satir's work through Jerry Weinberg. And I love Jerry. Used to have a motto on his website that said, helping smart people be happy. Because these are different things. There's a whole lot of smart technical people who are not very good at, you know, in the emotional world and need to learn some of these techniques. And I found Virginia Satir's work very good at modeling this stuff and understanding it when you've got a technical mind.
What do you think is the most important soft skill in such a tech world, like in the tech environment?
I was going to say listening, but probably empathy, because good listening depends on empathy for the other person. Trying to listen to what they mean to say rather than what you expect them to say. I did a session with Jerry Weinberg years ago on Satir's self-esteem toolkit, and he invited us to add to the toolkit things you need. And I thought, well, what I need is an ear trumpet to hear what people mean rather than what I'm expecting them to say. And so I couldn't find an ear trumpet charm, but I found this French horn charm to substitute. And so I've been wearing this now for, 16, 18 years, you know, to help me remember, you know, when something doesn't make sense, well, wait a minute, let me listen to what it sounds like to them. What does it mean to them? And that helps me a lot.
Oh, no, I'm very sensitive. So when you say things like that, I already get teary eyes. Sorry. Okay, Paul, you go on. I can't now.
One of the things I noticed from your book is you use questions a lot to explore understanding and in order to try to question assumptions and to develop understanding and empathy. In fact, your book contains 702 questions. I counted them.
Is that just at the ends of chapters or is that all through the chapters?
That's throughout the chapters. I just did a search for the question mark. So including the ends of chapters, there are 702 questions in your book. What kind of questions are useful when you suspect a misunderstanding?
The do you mean question is helpful a lot to try to straighten out that misunderstanding. If you look at Virginia Satir's ingredients of interaction, then you may walk through the different parts there and question each one of those. You know, I heard you say this. Is that what you said? If you don't get, you know, hear the right words, then, you know, you're probably not going to get to the right place. When you said that, did you mean this? And maybe try some examples. Did you mean like this or like that? So there's all that. I talk about the rule of three in there. And that's one of my great question generating things is somebody says something or I hear something or something happens and I make an interpretation. And then I say, well, they couldn't have meant this. That would be stupid. So I've only got two options. And I've become sensitive to noticing when I've only got two options and say, well, what's a third option? Because those two options, things don't happen just on a linear spectrum. The world is much more complex than that. And so sometimes it takes me a long time to come up with that third option. But when I do, usually I think of others too, because then I'm no longer in this Boolean frame of mind where this is either true or false. Oh, well, maybe there's aspects of this that are true and aspects that are false, you know. And that's where you start finding the possibilities and the partial common ground. So I've learned to question things and hold on to the questions. I try to hold on to data and the questions I have rather than the conclusions I came up with at the time, because I don't trust those conclusions. But sometimes I go back and I look at it. My early notebooks had a lot of conclusions. Later notebooks, I try to write down the data, what people said, what they did. And sometimes I go back and look at those, you know, and I have, oh, I wonder if this was going on. And I come up with different ways of looking at it. So learning to question yourself and question your conclusions and questioning your assumptions is very helpful and gives you more options. And then you can make choices. You know, that's what it's really about, is making choices and not feeling like you're a victim of the situation.
Is that where all of the dialogues and questions in the book came from mining your notebooks?
Oh, Not so much from mining those notebooks. I did look back at some of them. Also had conversations with people. I had a wonderful conversation with a colleague about a real world experience she had had. And I didn't know enough about that domain to be able to anonymize it and use it directly. But a lot of the things out of that conversation ended up going into some of these situations that I wrote in the book.
Isn't that one of the wonderful things about mentorship is how much the mentor learns?
Yeah, it's a great side effect. But speaking actually of books, as far as I've seen, I think on Amazon, on Leanpub, there are two other books that you wrote. Which of the books that you wrote you enjoyed the most? Which of the writing process was the most interesting, the most enjoyable for you?
Oh, well, they're all quite different. This is my first professionally edited book. And working with an editor made the book so much better. It did not make it easier. but I learned to really, really enjoy working with her. You know, she had insights that I couldn't have, you know, a different point of view. The evolutionary anatomy book, I wrote the first draft of that in a weekend, 40 hours. That was terrible. But I wrote it to try to pull my thoughts together for a talk I'd promised to give on the topic. And I didn't know how I was going to talk about it. the patterns of agile journeys, that was quite pleasant. You got, you know, four co-authors with that. And that started out of a session at a retrospective facilitators gathering someone else led, where we kind of drew maps of an agile journey we had been part of. And then we looked at the similarities of those maps, and we noticed, you know, we looked at those maps and just talked through them, and we noticed a lot of similarities. Well, this situation on this map, this event on this map, is similar to this one on that one. And so we decided to, why don't we write a book about this? You know, we can come up with little patterns that we've noticed here and put it into a book. And so it was a lot of fun working with other people on that. With five co-authors, I'm sure the tone is a bit uneven throughout the book, because different ones of us wrote different parts, different ones of us, you know, acted as editor and proofreader on different parts. So it's probably a little uneven, but I think it's a useful book. It you know, people still buy it. So they're all very different. You know, working with other people on it had its own pleasure. Work doing it all at once, well, that was pretty intense. It was not all bad. It was a tough weekend. and then this one, I had been collecting, you know, snippets on this for a long time. And in fact, when I went to Pragmatic, then I had a complete manuscript. I had, I think, my seventh version of the complete manuscript, because I had reorganized and rewritten a bunch of times. And so my editor looked at it and says, "Oh, this, I like what you've written here. First thing we need to do, though, is rewrite the table of contents." So I knew I had to rewrite it yet again. But the book is much better for it. This was a very hard book to write, but I'm really pleased with the way it came out.
Perfect. Yeah.
Been delightful to meet you. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you for inviting me. This has been wonderful.
So that was our interview with George Dinwiddie. I hope you found it as enlightening as I did. He's a lovely, lovely man, isn't he?
Yeah, it was the first time that I was almost crying online. So yes, he put me through some emotions, but they are good. Like, I would say he put me into reflection mood, and I wouldn't expect estimation topic to put me in such a deep reflection mood. So.
Well, you cried at the last one too, when Ryan said that a Scrum Master should love their team.
Ah, okay. Oh my God. You see, I already forgot that. Yes, exactly. Oh my God.
So I think we've got a new component to the podcast. We started the podcast, all of our podcasts, with the same basic framework, and we didn't realize that Paul's rants were going to be a new component to that framework. And I think that Justina's tears are now so a podcast isn't really open. Oh, a podcast isn't really over until Paul has had a rant and Justina has cried.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So if you want to hear more of my tears and Paul rants, make sure you join us every month.
So thank you so much for being with us today. Stay safe, stay indoors, and we're all going to come out of this okay. Goodbye.
Bye.